Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
This vibrant, tarnished world is a mixed-media installation created by artist Jennifer Ely French in response to the themes of nostalgia and longing in Station 11, a novel by Emily St. John Mandel.
Station 11 is part of the National Endowment for the Arts Big Read, which is a community-wide celebration of a selected novel. The Big Read in Billings kicks off this month with a local artist's take on some of the dystopian themes that come up in this novel.
Jennifer is a Montana artist, but you've moved back to Billings. And the reason we have you in the studio is you have a very exciting one-woman show coming up at the Northcutt Steel Gallery on the campus of MSU Billings in collaboration with The Big Read, which is a national program where a lot of people read the same book. And you are our guest artist for the program.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And the book is phenomenal. We'll try not to give too many spoilers. If you haven't read Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, I couldn't put it down. It took me 2 days to get through it, and it was just a page-turner. I'm so glad to have gotten a chance to read it before we talk about this art installation that you've themed around this book. And Corby, you've got a little bit of backstory about the book, because it's complex.
It's very complex. It moves back and forth in time over 20 years. But let me give a little introduction without really telling the whole story of it. Station 11 tells the story of a small band of actors and musicians 20 years after a flu pandemic has wiped out 99% of the Earth's population. Like other books in the dystopian post-apocalyptic genre, it highlights the fragility of our existence, our violent nature, and our capacity to survive despite the inevitable hardship of starvation, loneliness, and chaos. But this is really where the similarities change in the story Emily St. John Mandel chooses to tell, because it's not one of horror and mayhem. It's really about hope, even though the society has collapsed. Station 11 describes a world of hope, of people coping with nostalgia and loss, both in the present and the future, of the power of art and the relationship to fulfill us, sustain us, and nurture us back to our best selves. So in the story, there's a traveling symphony, and they return to a settlement, which is inside of a big airport. And near the climax of the story, we find this community of functioning people, 300 people, living in this airport, and it's the home of Museum of Civilization, which is a collection of old world artifacts, things like credit cards, car engines, even a pair of red stiletto heels, things that have survived but have somewhat lost their meaning.
Yeah, who needs stilettos in a post-apocalyptic society?
When there's no electricity, what do you need an engine for? Why do you need a cell phone? But Station 11 is really an ultimately hopeful book, and it's a reminder that art, whether it's a play, a comic book, music, or a museum display, can be the best means towards cultivating a civilization and preserving our humanity. So when we thought of a museum display, Jennifer, you are the person we turn to. Tell us a little bit about your work prior to doing this display.
Well, when I was approached to do this project, I had recently read the book and I was already a big fan, so I was really excited to get this project. I wasn't exactly sure for a little while how I was going to interpret it visually. It's kind of a big challenge to take a book with so many tangents and ideas and interpret that in a visual way that would make sense for my work and also make sense in the space at the school where it's going. It's kind of a specific space with the cases in front and everything. I had recently done an installation piece at the Stapleton Gallery, and it was my first immersive installation, and it's something I'd been wanting to do for a long time. So I knew when I heard about this project that I wanted to do something along those lines.
So this installation is going to be something that people really participate in.
Well, not exactly participate, but hope
experience it.
Yes. I think the word I would like to use is immersive. I hope it is immersive.
Similarly to, you mentioned that Stapleton show where you walk in, there's an environment that is created. There's something more dimensional about the work that creates a little bit more interaction, perhaps.
Yes, my installation at the Stapleton Gallery was very immersive. And so for this show, I'm planning to do a lot with the lighting to create an atmosphere. I'm using predominantly an old-fashioned carousel slide projector, which is kind of the heart of the show and how it ties in with the book and the nostalgia for electricity and nostalgia for old technology. The title of the show is This Vibrant Tarnished World. And I landed on that title as I was listening to the book for the second time, working in my studio, kind of working on other things and letting my mind wander and trying to come up with ideas for this installation. And I was just kind of writing phrases and things that struck me on my studio wall. And I noticed that the character of Kirsten at one point calls the post-apocalyptic world that she lives in, she refers to it as vibrant. And another character, the prophet, who is kind of the dark, her dark counterpart in the story. They're kind of the two children that, well, I shouldn't give anything away.
But they are survivors.
they're both survivors, and they have taken their survival and done very different things with them. And at one point, the character of the prophet refers to this afterworld as tarnished. And I thought that kind of perfectly embodied the two approaches that the characters have to life after the collapse. Like, Kirsten travels with the symphony, and she's a Shakespearean actress, and she chooses to bring hope and beauty to these little villages around the surviving world. And the prophet is a dark character that...
One of the things that we will be talking about as we have book discussions for Station 11 is, what are the things that we care about? What do we value? If it was the last thing to take onto a deserted island, or the world was ending and there was no more cell phone or electricity, what would you carry and what would you care about?
I love, Jennifer, that you've created this this tie back to technology, to the carousel, to the clunking of slides. Like,
yes.
I just think about how far we've evolved past that usefulness period of a slide projector, for instance. And there's a lot
DVDs even are going away.
Right.
Yeah. When's the last time you saw a CD player in anything? And so in this book, they become these interesting sort of relics of a society that no longer exists. And I like that you've come back to something that you found on eBay.
I did.
and then the process, too, is really interesting, that you were taking these objects that were so precious to you, photographing them, taking those digital images, turning them into slides, and then they'll be projected. But yeah, there's this section in the book, I think, to me, really speaks well to Emily St. John Mandel's writing style, her poetic voice, but also ties into all the things that perhaps are forgotten or taken for granted in this post-apocalyptic world. So if you'll allow me just a moment, I'm just going to read this. It's the chapters I love, too. Some of them are lengthy. Some of them are one page. So this is a one-pager. It's called An Incomplete List. No more diving into pools of chlorinated water lit green from below. No more ball games played out under floodlights. No more porch lights with moths fluttering on summer nights. No more trains running under the surface of cities on the dazzling power of the electric third rail. No more cities. No more films, except, rarely, with a generator drowning out half the dialogue, and then only for the first little while until the fuel for the generator ran out. Because automobile gas goes stale after 2 or 3 years. Aviation gas lasts longer, but it's difficult to come by. No more screens shining in the light, half lit as people raise their phones above the crowd to take photographs of concert stages. No more concert stages lit by candy-colored halogens. No more electronica, punk, electric guitars. No more pharmaceuticals. No more certainty of surviving a scratch on one's hand, a cut on a finger while chopping vegetables for dinner, a dog bite. No more flight. No more towns glimpsed from the sky through airplane windows, points of glimmering light. No more looking down from 30,000 feet and imagining the lives lit up by those lights at that moment. No more airplanes, no more requests to put your tray table in its upright and locked position. But no, that wasn't true. There were still airplanes here and there. They stood dormant on the runways and in hangars. They collected snow on their wings. In cold months, they were ideal for food storage. In summer, the ones near orchards were filled with trays of fruit that dehydrated in the heat. Teenagers snuck into them to have sex. Rust blossomed and streaked. No more countries, all borders unmanned. No more fire departments, no more police. No more road maintenance or garbage pickup. No more spacecraft rising up from Cape Canaveral, from the Bangkor Cosmodrome, from Vandenberg, all these places I can't pronounce, burning paths through the atmosphere into space. No more internet, no more social media. No more scrolling through litanies of dreams and nervous hopes and photographs of lunches, cries for help and expressions of contentment and relationship status updates with heart icons, whole or broken, plans to meet later, pleas, complaints, desires, pictures of babies dressed as bears or peppers for Halloween. No more reading and commenting on the lives of others, and in doing so, feeling slightly less alone in the room. No more avatars.
That is so beautiful. In both the writing, but and I can tell you're a poet because you read that like a poet.
You read that very well.
Thank you. I think it's one of the reasons I did really gravitate towards Emily's novel because I'm not much for science fiction or dystopian novels. I spend my time in poetry and a lot of creative nonfiction work. So I was hesitant to pick up this book. I think, Corby, like you expressed, maybe not necessarily in your wheelhouse, but it's a really well-told story and back to the idea of what we do carry or keep with us, what is precious to us after all that we know, something as simple as our cell phone with our likes and our updates is gone.
And Jennifer, I'm familiar with your work, and we will have some images on our website of some of the pieces in the show. But could you describe a little bit of your influences in terms of how you create both sculpture and painting?
Well, for this particular show, I've done things that I've really never done before. Again, when I started, I was a little at a loss as to how I was going to interpret this book visually. It seemed like a big challenge. I'm primarily a painter. I consider myself a painter, but, you know, I've been veering off into more three-dimensional things. I paint skulls, for example. But again, it's painting. So as a way to get a foothold into this project, I just started making some paintings about the book. I like all the references she makes to other art forms and even pop culture. And, you know, the references to Midsummer Night's Dream and King Lear. And Mozart.
And comic books, the graphic novel.
And the graphic novel, yep. Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Voyager.
The survival is
survival is insufficient comes from Star Trek Voyager, and that ties in with her graphic novel, which is all about space travel. So I made a few paintings that just refer to the references she makes to other art forms in the book, just as a way to start. And then thinking about this book, I knew I wanted to do something with electricity, to make electricity feel tangible, because every single character in the post-apocalyptic world is pining away for electricity all the time. I mean, I feel like every character, even before the collapse, is longing for something or nostalgic for something. Everybody feels a little bit unsatisfied even before the collapse. But I wanted to do something with technology, and I came upon the idea to do something with slides, because the slide projector, an actual slide projector. So I made this physical object out of a clock housing. And I think of it as maybe a stage or a reliquary for my precious things. I am somebody that had a very nomadic childhood. We moved around. My dad worked for an oil company. We moved every 2 to 3 years when I was growing up. So you get rid of things as you move. You jettison things that aren't meaningful, but you end up with this like small cache of things that I would never get rid of no matter what. And they're not necessarily useful. They're just things that I love or things that tie me to something in my past that I miss. So I wanted to honor those things with this reliquary and tie back to the things in the book that people keep, the things that aren't useful.
And so you've made a stage out of an old clock with its innards extracted.
I took the innards out. Right. I photographed my objects inside this reliquary.
What kind of objects?
Oh, there were about 60 of them, so they range a lot. I have feathers from a bird that I had when I was little. I have lots of things to do with my twin boys. Things to do when they were in the hospital for 2 months after they were born. So I have a lot of things to do with them. Just some random things that I just think are beautiful that I always have in my studio as inspiration. Art supplies. I have one particular paint that it's like my magical paint. I can't live without it. So I even put that in there. But there are about 60 and they cycle through this slideshow. So I took pictures of them inside my reliquary. I sent the digital images to a guy somewhere. I don't know. I found
that
him online.
Still makes slides.
And he made slides for me.
That's awesome.
And sent them back through the mail. And then I took my slide projector. I put the slides in the slide projector and I projected the one image of the reliquary onto a huge 6-foot by 9-foot raw canvas, which to me refers back to the Traveling Symphony with their Midsummer Night Dream painted canvas that they take everywhere with them. So I projected the image onto the canvas. I painted that image using the projection and left the middle, which is the center where the items go, bright white. So when the images are projected onto the canvas and they cycle through, it's as though the outside is three-dimensional and the object in the middle changes.
I'm curious how your brain works. This is fascinating to take all of these dimensional objects and create almost a flat version of them. So
and then back and then three-dimensional again.
Yeah.
It's like three-dimensional to flat and then back. I had this idea and it took months to execute and I was never sure it was going to work until it actually did work in the end.
I guess there must have been some trial and error, but maybe that feeling of risk, like there's a great risk in creativity.
Yeah, I mean, the best I find for myself, the ideas that are always the best are the ones where I think, no, I can't do that. And then I say, yes, I can. I'm going to try to do it. And I'm really happy with the way it turned out. It's definitely the heart of my show.
I just know as an artist that if you don't take risk, if you don't stretch yourself a little bit, you're going to be painting ducks for the rest of your life.
Right.
Well, and I'm curious how the book really impacted you thinking about these relics, these items that, I mean, obviously you're surrounded by things that are precious and you care about, and you're going to be putting them on display as though they were in a museum. There's got to be a bit of vulnerability in it all, but also maybe a sense of what are these things? What is that moment of nostalgia, that twinge that we get with those items?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have, this is the most personal show I've ever done. It's also one of the biggest that I've done by myself. And it feels, yes, it definitely feels vulnerable putting those items up there. But I hope that a viewer wouldn't necessarily need to know me or know exactly what those things represent to feel something when they look at this show.
So your show will open at the Northcutt Steel Gallery on Thursday, January 17th.
Yes.
And people that are interested in seeing the show can also pick up a copy of the book Station 11 and sign up for a book discussion group. We will have panel discussions and films all through the end of January and February at MSUB campus, so people can find out a little bit more. I really love the idea that people's first experience to the book is going to be your visual interpretation of it.
Yeah, we'll see.
And and hopefully that will invite them in.
What could this book be about? Well, I don't know if they'll necessarily know what the book is about from looking at my show, but I hope that the feelings I wanted to get across will be there. And those were the things, what I feel the predominant emotions from this book were nostalgia, longing, hope, you know, eventually.
Yeah, there's a hopefulness to it despite a complete shift in everything that they know.
Mm-hmm. And just the endurance of art, the endurance of that, you know, she talks about Shakespeare living in a time when during plague and with no electricity, and how relevant it is that they're performing Shakespeare, that the ability for art to speak to people across 600 years like that is also what I think this book is about. It's the, and art is what connects all of the characters in this book. It's all, they are all connected by the graphic novel that Miranda works on throughout her mm-hmm. life, that ties all of the characters together.
There's such a humanizing piece to art that allows them to all, like you said, have that entry point, that connection to mm-hmm. one another, despite mm-hmm. Some of their great differences. So yeah. It's really relevant to today's society.
Yes.
And with no government shutdown, what are you going to take into the 2019 world?
Let's hope the grid doesn't go down. Yeah.
The big read, too, I think is an important thing to mention, because it's happening across the country. There's multiple communities that have NEA grants for the Big Read, and Billings is one of about 30 communities that will be focusing on this particular novel. So it's fun to be part of a national conversation.
Yes.
And every community does their own interpretation of the book. I know that a lot of the Big Reads are held at sort of formal city libraries, and they always have a student component to it. We did the Big Read of The Roundhouse, Louise Erdrich's book, last year, and involved the Native American community, and it was so powerful, mm-hmm. you know, reaching a new audience. And I think Station 11 and the sort of quirkiness of your work will appeal to a really broad audience. I think young people will be so fascinated by images that aren't as literal mm-hmm. as things that they have seen, or it invites them into sort of exploration.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of your quirkiness, I love the piece that you had in the Stapleton Gallery's recent show, The Trophy Room.
Oh,
it was the one on the wall where it was a skull mount. The whole thing was painted in this intricate, mm-hmm. beautiful, but it wasn't just the skull. I mean, even the mount itself mm-hmm. was a piece of art. And I understand that a lot of your physical objects, like these skulls, come from your family's ranch that you collect and paint.
I first started doing the skulls a couple years ago by just walking around on my family's ranch and finding them and wanting to make them into art. I started painting. I think the way I approach painting the skulls is the same way I approach all of my work. It's, throughout my career, it's kind of been this drilling down of finer and finer and finer detail to the point where it gets a little ridiculous sometimes. But I approached each project I made for this show, the physical objects, not the slide projector, but the physical objects that are, you'll see around the room. Each one has a really, really high degree of detailing. I think that's how they tie in with my skulls and my other painted work.
Yeah, where does that intricacy come from for you?
I'm very inspired by medieval art, but also, like, as I work on a piece, it's almost like taking a journey through the piece, and that's how I think of my viewer as well. Like, I don't want it to just be one note. If you look at it multiple times, you're going to see something new in it each time you look at it. And there are many pathways that you can take through each piece.
And the viewer has an option to bring his own story.
Absolutely.
Or her own story
always,
to
yes.
the piece.
Yes, always.
It's interesting that you are in, you know, that you gravitate towards medieval art and that intricacy and all of the complexities of it. And it's so old. Is there something about it that attracts you based on just how long it's been around?
Oh, yes, for sure. But I also lived in England when I was in high school. And I think living amongst all that history when my aesthetic was being formed really had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I remember when I went to Boston and mm-hmm. was just so impacted by the age of the cities out there. And yeah. yet, I think, how new America
is. And Boston
is
relatively new.
Right?
I know. Montana is so new.
You said in your artist statement that relics from the future depict objects submerged in the ocean of time, encrusted with natural growth and debris from a lost civilization. Oh my mm-hmm. gosh, that sounds so wonderful. I love
detritus.
The idea.
Detritus. Great
encrusted.
Word.
I love the word detritus. The themes that I wanted to pull out of this book, and the themes I definitely started with as I worked on this project, I worked on it for 6 months, so ideas and themes kind of came and went and went off on tangents while I was working on this. But the idea of longing and memory were kind of what stayed with me throughout this process. So I was just going to read a little short excerpt that I think says a lot about memory.
And where are we at in the book at this point?
So
are we in the future?
Or? We are in the future and 20 years after the collapse. And this is where Kirsten, who's the protagonist, is she's being interviewed by this man, Diallo, who is a kind of an archivist. He as people come through his town, he interviews them, and he's also working on a newspaper. He's really trying to document people's personal experiences during the collapse so that society remembers what happened. So this is just part of an interview that he is doing with her as she's passing through town. She's told him that she didn't remember the first year she was walking after the collapse. So he says, Diallo, the children seemed awfully traumatized. Raymond, so that's Kirsten is Raymond. At the time, sure, everyone was. But 2 years later, 5 years, 10, look, I was 8, 9 when we stopped walking. I can't remember the year we spent on the road, and I think that means I can't remember the worst of it. But my point is, doesn't it seem to you that the people who have the hardest time in this current era, whatever you want to call it, the world after the Georgia flu, doesn't it seem like the people who struggle the most with it are the people who remember the old world clearly? Diallo, I hadn't thought about it. Raymond, what I mean to say is the more you remember, the more you've lost. But you remember some things, but so little. My memories from before the collapse seem like dreams. I remember looking down from an airplane window. This must have been sometime during the last year or two, and seeing the city of New York. Did you ever see it? Yes. Raymond, a sea of electric lights. It gives me chills to think of it. I don't really remember my parents, actually just impressions. I remember hot air coming out of vents in the winter and machines that played music. I remember what computers looked like with the screens lit up. I remember how you could open a fridge and cold air and light would spill out. Or freezers, even colder with those little squares of ice trays. Do you remember fridges? Diallo, of course. It's been a while since I've seen one used for anything other than shelving space. Raymond, and they had light inside as well as cold. Am I just imagining that? Diallo, no, they had light inside. So,
isn't that amazing?
I thought it was a beautiful passage.
To not be sure what a refrigerator was like, and you only have a memory of that.
Well, and then that line, the more that you remember, the more that you've lost. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to these items that we keep around us. We don't want to lose that, and our memories are fallible and fragile.
And the importance to create them, the importance to make art, to make music.
Yes.
So, Jennifer, we are excited to see this wild exhibit that will be opening on Thursday.
Thursday the 17th.
January 17th.
Mm-hmm. 5 to 8.
And it will run for about 5 or 6 weeks up at MSU Billings. Mm-hmm. And people can stop by to see the show and also pick up a copy of the book Station 11, which is a free book we'll be giving away. And you can sign up for a book discussion group. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.